Welcome to our newest episode of Living Downstream. This week, we have quite the lineup. You'll hear interviews with Frances Etherington, known to some as the Lorax of the Umpqua, Jesse Berger, a graduate student focusing on beaver restoration, and local resident Cindy Hawes, who's currently engaged in pond and wetland restoration in Southern Oregon. My name is Ryan, and I am the host of Living Downstream. I'm an AmeriCorps member serving in the role of Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for the organization Umpqua Watersheds. Before we begin, I'd like to do a land acknowledgement. I think it's important to remember that the land upon which Umpqua Watershed is located was formerly occupied by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, and Malala, among others. We have a special treat to begin today's episode, a poem written in honor and celebration of one of our interviewees.
The Lorax of the Umpqua by Alan Bunce, 2015. If a tree in the forest comes down to the ground with no one to hear it, does it make a sound? Yes, it does. Is there something you're missing? Trees do make a sound. You must just learn to listen. And so our story began a long while ago. Here in our backyard, where big old trees grow. Something was stirring, there arose a great noise. Machines and their masters, men with their toys. As fast as they pleased with their axes and saws, men cut down the forest, logged without laws. Chopping down timber faster than they could haul it. No care in the world, except for their wallet. With a banner of progress, trees kept coming down to build up our mills, to build up our town. Timber capital of the nation is what we became. We cut trees together. No one was to blame. But then it happened, as often things do, that someone woke up, maybe someone like you. They ventured outside and saw the destruction. We must warn the others of money's seduction. We must do something before trees number zero. They're going so fast. What we need is a hero. We need to find someone who will speak for the trees. Stand up to big timber. Bring them to their knees. We needed a champion. We had no second chances. Then along came a savior. Along came a Frances. She climbed up a mountain and shouted a chorus. Keep your hands off our trees. Stay out of our forest. She took on the industry, the county, state, and feds. She gathered protesters to scream off their heads. Oh, the battles she's fought for the trees and the river. When some hear her name, their knees start to quiver. She's protected the coho, or silvers, if you please. Murrelets, owls, and plovers, who all rely on the trees. And now she's back here, near the end of her mission, so much of her work coming into fruition. She's shown us the way to be a voice for the voiceless, make important decisions, a choice for the choiceless. So when you hug a big tree, put an ear to its branches, you may just hear a story of a hero named Frances.
Our first interview is with Frances Etherington, former Cascadia Wildlands Director. She also does a conservation program for KQUA. It is largely due to her efforts that forests in and around the Umpqua watershed were conserved. Today, she'll be talking with us mainly about her trail cam footage, as well as the importance of protecting mature native forests.
To start out, can you share a little bit about your background, you know, the work you've done, how it relates to wildlife and wildland conservation or protection?
My background is in forestry. I started out with a tree planter with HODADS back in the 1970s. And by the mid-90s, I started volunteering with Umpqua Watersheds. And in 1997, I became the Umpqua Watersheds Conservation Director. And until I moved to Cascadia Wildlands in the mid-2000s. around, I think, 2008 is when I went to Cascadia Wildlands. So my job with both those organizations was to monitor public land projects from federal agencies, in particular the Roseburg BLM, Coos Bay BLM, the Umpqua National Forest, and the Elliott State Forest. So those were my areas where I monitored projects for compliance with environmental laws. And I participated in the NEPA process. I don't know if your listeners know what the National Environmental Policy Act is, NEPA. It's where the federal agencies has to tell the public what they're doing, accept public comments, and then make a decision after considering those comments. And then the public has a right to appeal those decisions. So that's the whole NEPA process that I did for those four federal agencies, and something similar for the state agency, the Elliott.
Wow.
So I did that until I retired in 2016. Okay. And I am still working on contract with Cascadia Wildlands.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think we don't really stop working, you know, if we're doing something that we are really passionate about.
I like to call, people would ask me what I do for a living, and I would tell them I'm a professional complainer and a typist. So that's what it involves.
All right. Why do you think the conservation of old growth forests specifically, forests in general, but old growth forests is so important?
Well, old growth forests are our native forests. So both old growth forests and forests that have never been logged before, no matter how old they are native forests, they're rare. We don't have very many of them left. So that's why the conservation is important. There's a fair amount of wildlife that have adapted to these old forests, to these native forests, that cannot live in tree plantations. So either you have a native forest or you have a tree plantation, and the tree plantations are sort of a biological desert. They don't really harbor much wildlife because there's no diversity of tree species and tree ages, and the older trees sometimes have more places for wildlife to live in them than little tiny young trees.
Yeah. I was reading something the other day about how, you know, there's different, even bird species. Some will live in snags and some will live in, you know, the crevice of this type of tree or that type of tree, and at different levels of canopy. So yeah, it's really important to have that diversity in terms of age and size and not have kind of more of a monoculture, all the same tree, all the same age.
And those tree plantations are much more flammable. So these days we're talking about how to reduce fire hazards. And there was a study that was done on the Roseburg BLM land. As you know, the BLM land is checkerboarded. Every other section is owned by the public, and every other section is owned by industry, corporate ownership. And those corporate ownerships have young tree plantations, and the public lands have more older forests. So in 2013, there was a wildland fire near Riddle called the Douglas Complex Fire. And there was a study done on this by Roseburg BLM and the University of California. And they determined that those young forests are far more flammable than mature forests because their canopies touch each other. They're all the same age. So the fire moves through those industrial forest lands far quicker and with far more devastation of tree mortality. So we need our mature public forests to help reduce the spread of wildland fire.
Yeah, no, that's really important to know. Do you know if, because I know when I was serving with AmeriCorps back in Vermont, there were some people who would try to go in and manage in a certain way, or like harvest some trees, but not all trees. I guess, do you think that that's an effective way to make it so there's not the monoculture all the same thing? But like, does that cause too much disturbance to, you know, old growth or native forests?
Well, one reason why harvesting some trees would cause too much disturbance is you have to have a way to get those trees out. And so you have to build logging roads. And the logging roads themselves have a lot of ecological problems. You know, they're prone to killing fish. They have a lot of sediment delivery into streams. They promote more public use of driving in those areas, and that's always more human starts for fire. And it's also more human disturbance of wildlife. So just taking out a few trees probably doesn't really solve the problem. What I mean, we need wood fiber, you know, we need paper, we need 2x4s. But, you know, way over half of our forests are already in managed plantations. And so that's the places we should continue to get the wood products we need. There is so few native untouched forests left that those should be continue to be left. We don't need to get our wood products out of those rare forests.
Right. There's other places we can get them. That's helpful. Thank you. Now, I know you've done some, you know, filming and photography of wildlife, and I've seen some of that footage. This has been really great to see, you know, coyotes and different things that we might not see just on our everyday hikes. When did you start filming or photographing wildlife and why?
So you're talking about some trail cams that I have.
Yeah.
And I post some of my footage on a YouTube station called Western Oregon Wildlife Trail Cams. So there you can see some of the footage you're talking about. I had a friend who had trail cams, and I was just fascinated with what they were getting. You're able to, you know, peek into the living rooms unknowingly, you know, of this wildlife. And so it's just fascinating to observe them. Right.
Yeah.
And to know what wildlife is in certain areas. One of my trail cams is in a seasonal creek, a creek that dries up in the summertime, except most seasonal creeks do have these little spring-fed pools that last all summer long. And so the wildlife is sort of forced to go to those places. So I have some nice footage of the wildlife in the seasonal creek. It's unfortunate that this wildlife is not better protected by industry regulations. The regulations that govern private land logging is called the Oregon Forest Practices Act, or the OFPA. It's the laws that govern private land logging. When it comes to these seasonal creeks, they're allowed to clear cut right over the top of them, leave no tree buffer whatsoever, and they're allowed to aerial spray herbicides, nasty herbicides, right over these seasonal creeks, including an herbicide called atrazine. Atrazine is so nasty that it's banned in all of the European Union.
Whoa.
Used with impunity in Oregon. No regulations against using it whatsoever in Oregon. So a lot of the wildlife that is filmed in this seasonal creek would be heavily impacted once industry decides to clear cut and aerial spray all these poisons right over their homes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that there aren't more regulations, because I know there have been lots of studies on different types of pesticides and herbicides as to their negative impact on kind of the untargeted species, especially near waterways. Yeah, I would have thought that there would have had to be buffers, you know, plant buffers around any waterways. So that's
the Oregonian ProPublica recently did a series of stories on how the timber industry has really taken over Oregon politics. They own Oregon politics. It's the timber industry who is on the Board of Forestry, who makes their own rules. So they sit on that board, they make their own rules, and they aren't going to do anything that would allow them to log 1 inch less of timber. I mean, the way they have it set up is they must be able to make every possible penny off their properties, you know, because private land, you know, sort of their so-called right to make as much money as possible, no matter how much of their impacts flows downstream and off their properties into the rest of our lives, especially the aerial herbicide spraying. You know, they'll come with small planes and helicopters, and they'll spew this atrazine out from the air. And believe me, it drifts. And in Oregon, you know, they're only required to leave 60 feet next to homes and schools.
Whoa.
You know, there is this whole movement that we should become part of Idaho. Well, I agree with that, because in Idaho, they have to leave a half a mile to protect people from these herbicides. In Oregon, our laws are so weak. They don't have to leave any buffer on small streams and virtually nothing with their aerial herbicide spraying.
Yeah, I wish there was a way, and I think there are ways, that I wish that current situations were such that we could... yeah, kind of all work together to find solutions that protect both people's, you know, welfare and making sure people are getting enough money, but also the wildlife, you know, protecting the environment. Because if we destroy the environment, destroy wildlife habitat, then the wildlife is just gone. You know, it's not like, oh, we can just continue to take without that reciprocal giving or protecting, because then we're just destroying others' homes.
Not to mention our own home. I mean, there goes to wildlife. We go soon after, you know.
Yeah, I guess just kind of thinking back to those trail cams, what's the most interesting footage that you've captured, or has anything surprised you that you've seen over the years?
I always enjoy it when I get the predators. I mean, you get to see the human side of them, if I might use that. I don't know what else you use besides the human side of them. It's just interesting to me to see their interactions with each other. I get a lot of birds, too, in the seasonal creek. And so it's really fun to see the birds. My latest one I just posted yesterday was all on... birds bathing in these creeks.
If any of our listeners are thinking about setting up their own trail cams, you know, on their property, to get a better sense of who's out there and, you know, what critters they might have homes for on their land, do you have any recommendations for kind of where to set those up? I know you mentioned the seasonal creek. I don't know if everybody has those or not, but like what recommendations, you know, in terms of level or like near what types of trees or anything that's worked really well for you?
You know, it's been a learning experience for me, and anybody who wants to start with a trail cam, just expect to have a learning experience as you go on. Sometimes I'll set up the camera really low so I can get the bobcats. But then when the elk walks by, I just get their knees.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so then, you know, I really love to capture the elk. They're such beautiful creatures. So then I have to put the trail cams higher.
Yeah.
And so, you know, where to put them, you know, water is always a good place, somewhere around water. It's also never a good idea to bait the trail cam area with food. Gotcha. I never do that. And you want to know what the wildlife is doing in their natural habitat. You don't want to make it unnatural habitat that you're capturing. So I never bait any. Baiting has a lot of problems for the wildlife. There's start to be competition where there wasn't before, and a lot of other problems. So I never put bait down to attract wildlife to the cameras. Instead, I try and find places on trails, wildlife trails, and water. I experiment, you know, some places maybe the elk will use more, so I'll put the camera up higher. Some places the coyotes will use more, I'll put it lower. So it's just a matter of fooling around. I've been doing it for 4 years now. So... it's taken me 4 years to get what I've got right now.
I think I've seen a video where, was it a bear or something came over and like moved the trail cam. So hopefully the trail cams people have are pretty hardy, right?
Bears and elk, those two wildlife species will be very curious about what this thing is out there that has this funny smell to it, and maybe a funny clicking noise, and they will both try and move the camera around quite a bit. So you know, I've also learned how to strap it really tight to a tree, put it in a security box, But it's not just a bear and the elk. And did you see that one where I had the owl? I had the camera on a tripod. And there was a big long handle on the tripod to move to adjust it. And so the owl landed on that handle and the whole thing just went shoo. But so anyway, yeah.
Huh. Yeah, I bet it's amazing for you and for other your viewers, you know, to see what the wildlife does, you know, when humans aren't right there, even if there is something that's, you know, maybe they're not quite used to, but I don't know, maybe over time they get a little more used to it and start doing what they typically do, which is pretty cool.
Right.
So kind of like before we go, how could or how have your videos been used in either a positive or negative way that you know of?
Well, I don't know of.
Okay. Well, I know that we had spoken a different time about the importance of kind of like protecting wild areas. And I've spoken with other people in some of my other interviews as well about how we have to be careful to find the balance between sharing a certain location where we've saw something, or whether it's a, you know, a really pretty but maybe rare flower or some sort of species, animal species. You know, it's interesting and exciting. We want to tell people, but we also have to be careful to kind of preserve those locations so that maybe people who don't have the best of intentions in terms of wanting to take that for themselves, either through hunting or through like taking seeds from maybe a rare plant. So just kind of keeping that in mind to protect, you know, things that maybe are endangered or have really low populations. And so showing something interesting about them, but without having that place marker.
Right. Yes. And so my cameras are all on various pieces of private lands where I have permission to access them. And but they're all very close to industrial private lands. And so when those neighboring lands get clear cut with the streams that flow through those neighboring lands onto the areas where a trail cam is set up, that's going to be quite a big change. To it'll be interesting to see the change, but not so interesting I want to see it at all. It's a problem in that nearby industrial forest land can really wreak havoc with the wildlife and on all the surrounding private lands. And even the surrounding federal lands, for that matter.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about, just like you said, the downstream impacts, both on water specifically, but also, yeah, you know, if there's something happening at one location, that's going to push the wildlife that can move elsewhere, for better or worse. So, yeah, I'm grateful for your footage and for the things that you've been able to capture and show other people. Yeah, I enjoy looking at those trail cams the videos when I'm able to. Thank you so much for being on our show. And yeah, I look forward to seeing more videos as they come out. Today, I'll be interviewing Jesse Berger, graduate student at Washington State University, who's studying beaver restoration. First of all, why beavers? Did you choose to study them specifically? And if so, why?
Yeah, so beavers are pretty new to me. I wasn't studying beavers before I got into this graduate program. I was actually working with spotted owls down in Southern Oregon for the last 5 years. What I'd been following my advisor, his name is Jonah Piovia Scott, and I've been following his lab and their research for a few years. I'm pretty interested in amphibians, and it's an amphibian conservation-based lab. Doing a lot of work with disease ecology and chytrid fungus dynamics and things like that, which is a fungal pathogen that's infecting amphibian populations across the West. So I reached out to him first in 2016, something like that, and he didn't have any funding or anything like that. So I reached back out to him in 2018 and then went through the whole process, and this is the project he offered me, which I jumped at because I had seen this movie at an environmental film festival of 2018 or 19 called Beaver Believers. And it really stressed the importance in terms of ecological impact and sort of historical context of beavers in North America. And so it was kind of primed in my brain when he offered me the project. I just kind of jumped at it. So like that's why I'm doing the beaver thing, but beavers in general, interest has really grown a lot in the context of, you know, aquatic restoration, freshwater management, and kind of framed in climate change in the West. So beaver restoration has been kind of implemented and a focus of a lot of managers for the past maybe decade or so. It's been increasing pretty rapidly. Climate change is predicting, you know, less snowpack in the West, which is where we get a lot of our fresh water, and just less rain in general, drier summers, hotter summers. And that water is really important for both amphibians, salmon, which is, you know, a huge conservation issue over here, and for the people. And so people, you know, conservationists and biologists started thinking about beavers and how they could potentially help. And they do, you know, their activities, which you're probably familiar with, such as damming and things like that. They really help keep water on the landscape. They create wetlands, they create deep ponds, they maintain water temperature, water flow throughout the year. And so people started realizing how important it was to keep them around or to use them to help restore water. It's a lot, you know, they do all the work for us if we can get them to stay somewhere. And then if you think about the historical context of beavers as well, I mean, estimates for beaver populations kind of pre-trapping, pre-1800s, 1700s, 1800s, big trapping boom, we're like 60 to 400 million, which is a huge range, but we're only at about 12 million right now. So, you know, the landscape was just fundamentally altered by beavers. They really were everywhere and really created a lot of habitat for the fish that we all like and a lot of the different species. I mean, there's a lot of research out there showing biodiversity impacts of beavers. You know, these beaver sites, they create these amazing, huge wetland systems that are great for everything, really, like invertebrates, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, birds, plants. It's just a huge boon to biodiversity as a whole. So that's kind of why beavers are interesting and why people are very interested in them. There's kind of three main ways that people are using beavers for restoration. One is just promotion of habitat and to kind of attract beavers to spots. And that would just kind of be, you know, planting willows, doing some restoration work to make the habitat good for them. So they'll show up and start doing what they do. Another one that's been implemented down there in Oregon and a few places are called beaver dam analogs, where we go in, people go in and they basically make fake beaver dams by pounding posts in and kind of weaving wood through to try to mimic the natural beavers dammings. And that tends to attract beavers if there's some around. It makes them easier for them to start building dams. And then the third one is actually translocation, where, you know, if beavers in the wrong place can be a big problem for people. They can dam culverts, flood roads, you know, eat apple trees, things like that. And traditionally, people basically trap them lethally, but there's a huge push to live trap them and move them somewhere where we want them. And that's where my research comes in. But yeah, you know, beavers have a long, long history here in North America, and really North American history is deeply intertwined with them. European colonization of the West wouldn't have happened without beavers. It was all driven by beavers, and beavers shaped all the aquatic resources we have here. So it's pretty interesting.
That sounds like you've bought in.
Yeah, I'm there. It'll be interesting to see how some of this stuff plays out, but I think that beavers are super important, and you know, they really are kind of that iconic keystone umbrella species that does just make this whole habitat more so than most other animals. So there's definitely benefits there.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what your graduate work entails? What are you hoping to discover?
Yeah, so for my graduate work, I'm tackling a little piece of this beaver story. So for the translocation projects, there's a lot of issues with figuring out what happens to them after you move them. It's not so easy as we put them there and they stay there. They kind of tend to move around. So there's a lot of work going into trying to figure out optimal habitats so they don't move, things like that, trying to figure out how to choose sites that work for our needs and their needs. And so one of the questions is how to monitor them after we put them somewhere. And so traditionally, you'll use like wildlife cameras or just beaver sign surveys where you walk a site and look for signs of activity. It's pretty hard to age activity. So, you know, unless it's pretty fresh, it's hard to tell how old it is. It can be. And then for the cameras, you know, if the beavers just leave, your cameras are in a single spot, you won't know. And they're in the water, so it's hard to get the pictures anyway. And so I'm working with this novel technology called environmental DNA, and that we're trying to figure out if we can use that to monitor these beavers. And environmental DNA is a new technology, new-ish, last decade or so, that's being used to monitor and detect species in different systems. Basically, you can think of it like, so every organism sheds DNA via skin, fur, feces, saliva, things like that. So you can sort of think of it as like dye. If you put a drop of dye in water and it slowly spreads out, that's how the DNA kind of disperse through a water system. And then each individual species has a unique DNA code, so you can tell which species is which. So you can kind of think of that as a dye of a different color, right? So each species would have its own color of dye. And it works really well in water. They have been using it on land some as well, but you know, if you put a drop of dye in dirt, it doesn't disperse quite as well. So you kind of have to be in the right spot. And so what we're able to do is go to a stream and take a water sample, just pump it through this really tiny filter. It's like 5 microns, which is really a fine filter. And you pick up the DNA and then you can see if the beaver DNA is there. And that should give you a pretty good indication of their presence. And so what we're doing, I'm radio tagging them and tracking them. So I'll be tracking their movements, and I'm pairing that up with these eDNA samples to see if we can figure out how their locations and activities correlates with DNA presence within a stream or a water system. The ultimate idea being that we could create kind of a protocol or a methodology where you could go out and take, you know, 2 samples and know if the beavers are there or not. There's a lot of other questions we might be able to answer too, but we'll see once we get all the data collected. We just started this year. So that's the main focus of my research. One of the other projects that I'm working on is going to use environmental DNA methods as well, but looking more at the disease side of things. So when you trap a beaver in one place and you move it to another, there's the potential that it could carry invasive species or aquatic pathogens, things like that. So we're working on developing kind of standardized methods for these beaver translocation projects to take samples from beavers before they move them, so we can kind of figure out if we need to do a quarantine period or something like that. Most of the beaver translocation projects have housing facilities because it's really more effective to move beavers as a family unit. And so you don't always trap them as a single unit. It can be pretty tough to trap all of them in one night. So they'll get a beaver and then they'll keep it for like a week or so while we're trying to get the rest of the family. And through that process, we're taking DNA samples from water that the beavers have access to kind of see if they actually carry any of these invasive species or aquatic pathogens. And second, to see if as they're in captivity, that DNA goes away and those pathogens and everything goes away as well. So hopefully, most of this research should have pretty, pretty strong connections to actual practical applications, which is something I'm excited about. I like that side of research. And we're working with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife with their beaver translocation pilot program. So I'm working with a bunch of different projects across the state. And so this has been my first year. I started in May, where we started off, you know, we hit the ground running, designing our research protocols and starting to gather data. So I've gathered data for all my different projects, sort of as a pilot and just getting things running. And then next summer, there's going to be a lot more. So we don't have a lot of answers to things yet, but we're excited.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I know you said you just started. Have you learned anything interesting yet or observed, you know, noticed something that's kind of stuck with you so far?
Well, you know, I think like part of this whole process of doing graduate research and being in graduate school is reading a lot of papers and a lot of research. And just through doing that has really kind of enhanced my appreciation for and understanding of beavers. And I think it's, you know, I think it's something worth reading about, even if you're not a scientist. It's just, it's a really interesting organism that wraps together social and natural history of North America. There's a really good book called Eager by Ben Goldfarb. It's pretty popular. It just came out maybe 2018, something like that. And it's a really good read, and it gives you a good summary of a lot of this stuff. He goes into the history, and he goes out with a bunch of different beaver translocation projects and kind of gets at that side of things as well. So it's pretty amazing. Yeah. And then like, I didn't really know anything about environmental DNA before I started either. So that's been, I knew some, cause that was something I was really interested in, but getting into that world has been really interesting. So there's some cool stuff there.
Yeah, it's neat, the different ways that species can be monitored or discovered or tracked. I conducted another interview with someone who's doing bird song monitoring, and they're using bioacoustic systems and to determine, you know, what birds are present. Even when, you know, people aren't there, they can just leave the equipment out. So yeah, it's pretty great how technology can be so helpful. I love when technology is used for good.
Yeah.
So
yeah, definitely. Yeah, and it, you know, it's all feels like it's happening so fast. Like technology is getting so, so powerful. And yeah, the environmental DNA thing, it is really promising. You know, there's a lot of dynamics to work out. There's some issues with like one organism shedding more DNA than other individuals of the same species, which is kind of complicated. It's like a super shedder type thing. Yeah. I mean, it's discipline that's ripe for more investigation. So I'm happy to be helping with that some. It's pretty cool.
It's exciting to be at the forefront of something and help make the protocols and things. I had an opportunity to do something like that back home, mercury analyzation equipment. Oh, cool. So yeah, helping develop the procedures and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we're using this backpack sampler, which is just like this kind of fancy pump with the computer on it that takes a lot of data. That's actually developed by a company that's based here in Vancouver, Washington. They're actually like a mile from campus. So we're doing on the side, we're doing some other kind of research with them, just learning about the dynamics of sampling and different types of sampling and how they compare to each other and stuff. So that, yeah, I mean, there's just, you know, my main research is two things, but there's like four other things I'm involved in just because that's the nature of grad school and everything that's going on, but it's pretty sweet.
What has been your biggest challenge, or what do you anticipate to be a challenge?
So far, COVID is a challenge. you know, I was working for about a month before I even got to really meet my advisor face to face. And even then it was, you know, masked up and distanced. So, but more than that, I think it's just, this year in particular, not many projects were operating, because they couldn't, a lot of people were furloughed. A lot of people were not working. Not many beavers got moved. So we didn't have a lot of opportunities. And hopefully things will be different come in the spring. But we'll see. It is, you know, it is kind of field work, remote work. I do a lot of work alone, so that it's nice to be able to still be doing things, but it's hard to move beavers alone. They're heavy. You need people to help you. And so that's been a challenge for sure, but we've been pretty successful so far in getting data and getting things done. So I think the next big challenge will be trying to expand and figuring out how that will fit into a pandemic world if that is the case come spring. Yeah, it's been interesting, as it's been for everyone.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about the different challenges and the different ways that COVID has played out in so many different facets of society, you know, whether it's closing down trails or making it so people can't go into work or can't have certain types of meetings, you know, just, yeah, it's very far reaching.
Yeah, it definitely is. We also had a fire in my study area, you know, kind of at the same, that same weekend when everything sparked off in Oregon. We had one up here in Washington, so I was shut out of the National Forest for a couple of weeks, which was right around the time when we were hoping to do some beaver translocation. So that was stressful, but it wasn't as bad as what you guys were dealing with down there. So it was okay. I was more worried about you guys than up here. So
yeah, so many different, you know, climate related challenges happening concurrently at the moment.
Yeah, so that's there's this new paper that came out recently called Smokey the Beaver, which has some pretty interesting evidence that beaver sites, you know, all that water, all that enhanced green riparian growth could actually act as fire breaks. So there could be some other connections into kind of climate resilience there, other than just, you know, water storage for wildlife and people, but just acting as fire breaks could be really a big benefit in a lot of places. So that's, you know, unfolding. It's not what I'm looking at, but it's definitely a huge area of interest in the beaver kind of restoration world. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I've heard of that too. I'll have to look into it.
Yeah, that paper is pretty recent, so should be interesting. And then there's another recent paper that actually came out of my lab from a postdoc who just left. They were comparing amphibian populations between dammed sites and undammed sites, and they found, well, they found a few things. They found, you know, the hydro period, the length that water was kept in those systems was quite a bit longer, and because of that, they think that there were a lot of slower developing amphibians that stay at their larval state or the aquatic state for a long time, and there were a lot more of them in the dammed sites than the undammed sites, and so general amphibian diversity was higher, a lot higher in the dammed sites than the undammed sites. So it's cool. Yeah. I mean, we're really just kind of his work. Dr. John Romancic, he kind of started, him and my professor, Dr. Jonah, they started this whole beaver research kind of program, and we're just kind of carrying it on to see what else we can find out. So
yeah, I think there'll be a lot of new and interesting things to learn. It's always exciting. Yeah. To be right in the midst of all of it.
Yeah. You know, it's been exhausting too. Grad school is pretty intense. We had a really good first kind of field season and first semester. So
what's the biggest misconception that people have about beavers?
I think so. One thing that I've heard a lot and something that I've come across a lot is people thinking that beavers eat fish, or eat, you know, other organisms. And I don't know, I think there's something in some popular media where beavers are like eating fish. And I've heard all these stories from people of beavers like herding fish and things to like eat them, but they're vegetarians. So beavers, they do eat trees, which is one of the issues with them, but they really only eat trees kind of in the fall and winter. And then during the summer and spring, they eat herbaceous growth. Yeah, I think that's kind of a big misconception. Another one is sort of that lethal control will solve your beaver problem. And a lot of the times, you know, the beavers are there because the habitat's good. And if you trap them and kill them, there's probably other beavers nearby that are going to find it eventually. And so, you know, there's a few ways to work with them. The translocation is sort of the same thing though, right? I mean, if you're taking beavers out of somewhere, you didn't do anything to make the habitat any less desirable, so you may get beavers again. And there's other ways. There's things called pond levelers where you can put this device in a beaver pond that helps funnel the water over the dam without them sort of realizing it. And that way you can kind of control the water level. And there's a lot of organizations that can help you figure that out and ways to manage your beavers, but the lethal control methods will not stop really unless you get them all, which isn't good. So yeah, I think those are two big ones.
Are there any ways that Oregonians can help local beaver populations or people from the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, I mean, I would say like one big thing is to read about it and sort of educate yourself and learn, you know, learn more so that when you talk to people, you can kind of share the importance of them and what they can really do for, you know, both people and for wildlife. That's a big one. I think another thing you can do is help support any beaver translocation projects. A lot of the time they're nonprofits, and if it's something you're interested in, get involved. They need people to help out, help carry beavers and things like that. They're always looking for volunteers in my experiences. You know, think about those lethal control measures and really kind of read about it and think, you know, if you're a property owner, open your mind to working with them instead of against them could really be helpful. You know, if you've got cattle and you need water, beavers will keep water on your ranch or and really help you out in the long run. But I think those are some good things. If you are having issues, I would imagine a lot of like local watershed councils could direct you in the right, you know, in the right direction to find people that could help you with beaver situations. And just local nonprofit, conservation nonprofits have some resources and connections. They may be able to point you in the right direction.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share with the audience about beavers or your studies or anything else?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we covered it pretty well. If you're, that book is Eager by Ben Goldfarb is a really good read. If you're interested in this and want to learn more about kind of the history of beaver translocations and just the context of beavers in North America, there's a lot of research out there. There's a lot of good media out there. The Metau Beaver Project here in Washington has probably been moving beavers longer than anybody in North America. They have a pretty good website to go check out too, if you want more information. Yeah. And overall, just support beavers. If you like fish, support beavers.
I like it. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really fun.
I now have Cindy Hawes, founder and president of the Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub, or UNLEASH. First, can you give our listeners a brief overview of your organization?
Sure. UNLEASH mission is to provide hands-on science learning and leadership opportunities to students and communities in Douglas County, Oregon.
Awesome. This episode focuses on the preservation and restoration of wildlife habitat, and I know that you're currently involved with some pond and wetland surveys in the area. Can you tell us a little about what you're hoping to find and why?
Well, people probably know that we've had considerable loss of wetlands. In the state of Oregon, it's estimated between 57% and 75% of wetlands have been lost. And wetlands are real important for a number of different processes and benefits that they provide to wildlife as well as to humans. That water storage is very, very valuable, and wetlands clean water. And as I mentioned, they provide for all the species of wildlife need wetlands. So we're actually working on wetlands that have been impacted by non-native invasive fish and bullfrogs, because that's having an impact on our native wildlife.
Okay. So what specifically are you looking for or measuring, or what data are you collecting?
Well, we've been working with the Umpqua National Forest and also with Susan Applegate, who has a wetland, to help them restore wetlands that are currently not functioning. They have invasive fish and bullfrogs, and we are implementing various techniques to remove the fish and the bullfrogs, and also measuring the response of native pond-breeding amphibians and western pond turtle to the removal of the species that prey upon them.
Yeah, I actually went out with Cindy recently for a frog survey. We were looking for the sort of gelatinous egg masses. Can you tell our listeners, I guess, just a little bit more about the northern red-legged frog?
Yeah, the northern red-legged frog, its a geographic distribution goes all the way into British Columbia and down into California. It tends to be a lower elevation species, but it also goes all the way up to 1,200 meters in elevation. It needs to have both these wetlands for breeding and depositing its eggs, as well as a moist forest habitat to complete its life cycle.
And why are the invasive, like bullfrogs, you mentioned bullfrogs, why are bullfrogs so harmful or detrimental to these northern red-legged frogs?
Well, bullfrogs eat them. And the thing that is that the northern red-legged frog, like a lot of our native amphibians in Oregon, evolved to put their eggs in wetlands where there were no predators. And so, unfortunately, humans decided to develop these wetlands for their own interest, and we added the bullfrog, and we added fish. And that has had a huge impact on all of the species that evolved these, you know, that's where they did their reproduction, that's how they maintain their population.
What other types of habitat restoration are you involved with, or is Unleash involved with?
We've been focusing mainly on wetlands and aquatic riparian habitats. We've been doing some education with youth in streams and riparian habitats, though we love to be involved in lots of different types of connecting youth and adults to our native wetlands and forests and any of our natural features here in our area. We're trying to do and encourage citizen science and especially get our youth back outdoors, learning science. And really, we want to encourage an ecological knowledge. And in doing that, for example, we have worked with youth ages 7 and to teenagers, and adult students as well. We've taken adult students to Yellowstone National Park to learn all about the trophic cascade effect of wolves in the Yellowstone ecosystem. And that was a really interesting experience. So we do different kinds of experiences for different audiences, yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share about habitat restoration or the importance of preserving wildlife habitat?
One thing I would like to share is that people probably don't realize that all across the Umpqua Basin, there are lots of these created ponds, as well as what were wetlands that have been made bigger and into more open water. And we have lost our habitat for these native species because of that in a couple ways. One is when you make those areas deeper, you lose the emergent vegetation, and with that, you lose these native species, the native amphibian species, and you also have an impact on your water quality because you're going to get more eutrophication in these open waters because you don't have the plants and the animals that are tied to the plants, like the tadpoles of the northern red-legged frog that eat the periphyton off of the algae and off of the plants. And so in order to really improve our water quality, everybody should realize that these ponds and wetlands on private and on public lands are real important for that. They're important for water storage, and the structure of them and the species that are in them are important for preventing eutrophication, which is that nutrient, you know, where you're getting too much nutrient input and you get lots of algae and other organisms that are undesirable and unhealthy for both wildlife and humans. Mm-hmm. And people may not realize that even if you have these ponds, if you have these ponds on your land, you may have bass or bullhead fish in them. And bullfrogs are bad, but these fish, these non-native invasive fish, are really bad. And you may not know that in the wintertime, when there's a lot of water, those wetlands can connect to the streams, and you could be spreading those invasive species to other places.
Yeah, that's an important reminder. How could people, if let's say they have property that either does or doesn't have a wetland or pond, how could they try to either restore or create habitat that's suitable for native species?
Number one, do not put any non-native species in it. Number two, make sure that you have a variety of depths of water in your wetland/lake/pond, because the different depths you have provides for the emergent vegetation to grow, and then you'll start getting a real diversity of all these different kinds of emergent plants, emergent wetland plants, that keep your water healthy and provide habitat for all the animals in the water that keep your water healthy. So that's real important, is to have a good ratio of emergent vegetation and shrubby vegetation, as well as having good high canopy forest habitat near your pond so that you're so that you can provide connectivity, because a lot of these species are not 100% aquatic. They actually go out and spend considerable time in the forests, in the downwood and in the leaf litter, if it's kept moist. That's why it has to be really good intact forest, so to provide them for the other part of their life cycle.
Awesome. How can people support or get involved with Unleash?
Well, we do have a website and we have a Facebook page, so you can certainly look us up on Facebook and on our webpage. And let us know you're interested in, and we do have an email that you can get from our website, and let us know you're interested in participating with us. And we'd be glad to incorporate you into some of our work.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
The intro and outro music for this show are excerpts from the song Forest by Vlad Gluchenko, used under the Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. You can find more information about this song in Living Downstream's information section.